Thank you for joining us at the Roundtable.
Brought to you by Community Education Arts, a nonprofit organization based in Noblesville, Indiana.
I'm Alice Cavanaugh-Scober, President of CE Arts.
And I'm Sarah E. Morin, Secretary of CE Arts. Let's sit down
at the Roundtable. Next up, Miss Kitty O'Doherty is going to share with us her incredibly poignant piece for Holly Middleton. Are you ready, Kitty?
Hi, thank you.
I know you now. Don't be nervous. You'll be fine.
I know.
You look like a deer in the headlights, but you'll be fine.
I am.
No, you'll be fine. You can do this. You got this, girl.
All right. It could have been only one of about a dozen of us middle-aged school kids inside Indianapolis apartment complex in late 1970, but it was Holly Middleton. In the summer, we'd all hang out at the pool, learning to swim, playing Marco Polo, getting Pepsi out of the vending machine, watching the teenagers doing their preening and working on their Indiana version of a Malibu tan. From the frosty fall mornings, we would huddle together at the bus stop in front of the complex, waking up and talking about homework, the monkeys, and our various blooming crushes. Holly wasn't my best friend, but she was a good friend by virtue of our shared social proximity in the apartment complex. She was a year younger than I and tall, but not the tallest of the kids. She was cute, very cute, so cute. Dark hair and laughed easily. She was fun. She was skinny and her knees were knobby. Sometimes she would bite her nails while she was listening to someone talk. I remember thinking that it looked oddly adorable. So for about a week, I tried biting my nails, but I looked ridiculous. Only Holly could make nail biting and knobby little knees adorable. On the bus rides home from school, we'd all be full of energy and the boys would be rowdy. Plans would be made for the time between homework and dinner to meet at the apartment playground or just walk around. This one particular afternoon, Holly went to the neighboring apartment of another girl to hang out, to do girl stuff. They probably planned to watch the popular late afternoon goth soap opera, Dark Shadows, and talk about everything 12-year-olds talk about, just like the rest of us were doing that December day. I had never been to a funeral home before. It was the mother of a friend who took a car full of us to say a final goodbye to Holly. The scene was so surreal. All of us kids were crying. Adults were crying. Holly was laying there in a white casket, our lifeless friend, surrounded by beautiful flowers. I remember worrying about her little sister, how everything would be with no Holly in the friend circle. And most of all, just how awful, awful, awful it was that the neighbor's brother brought a gun into the room where the girls were. Holly had died of an accidental gunshot to the chest at 12 years old. My family moved to the other side of town a month later, and I've thought about Holly many times over the years. What would she have been like in high school, or where would her life have taken her as an adult? She would be getting near retirement age now, same as the rest of us kids. It has seemed somehow personally important to keep her memory alive. I didn't know her parents, nor really her sister. And if there had been any way to say to them, yes, I very much remember Holly, I would love to have given them that at some point in the following years, to let them know that their daughter, their sister, is remembered even decades later. She was only 12. And it could have been any one of about a dozen of us, junior high age kids. But on that sad day, it was Holly Middleton, and I have never forgotten her. Thank you.
Katie, that was wonderful. That was just great. You did it. You did a really good job.
Thank you.
All right. Next up, kind of hard to just segue, but next up, Jean Roberts is going to read her beautiful poem, Snow on the Redbud.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Good to see you, Jean.
Snow on the Redbud. Being a description of a late April snow, 2021. Snow on the wildflowers and on the flowering trees. Fat, straight down flakes, turning the spreading purple redbud to pale violet. A red cardinal, black, red-winged blackbird, wait their turn, decorating the scene. All the birds are gathering, in sequence as in verse. Eat now is their message, in case it gets worse. All the birds are gathering, the woodpecker, the goldfinch, and the dove. The redbud's hue grows increasingly paler. His bark, its bark, the darker black. The scene whiter, the birds brighter. Snow sheds down from above. It should go on for hours. Finally, the tree was reduced to black and white. A puffed up wren calls from a sheltered spot. A great squirrel chase across the lawn and into the woods beyond. Competition under the feeder between a little red squirrel and a large gray squirrel. The little one drives the larger squirrel off. He also owns the spot versus a chipmunk after many graceful skirmishes. Snow turned finer and accumulated. Here's the red squirrel running off a cardinal family. Finally, the dove family, like fat muffins, and the larger flowing squirrels. An inch and a half of snow. A cardinal in a deep green arborvitae tree with white snow-topped branches surveys the busy scene, looking for his opportunity. 2 inches of snow. Rotate again to my neighborhood birds. The chickadee, the titmouse, doves, woodpecker, cardinal. They look so urgent and desperate, they ate it all by dark. 2.5 inches of snow. It's still snowing, and we are swamped in white. Dusk settles after all the seed is consumed. 3 inches of snow. Finally, everything is covered with white, like icing over dark twiggy bark, more icing than cake. This blue light of twilight that I've always loved, greenish tonight under these heavy clouds. And then the power went out. Thank you.
Great job, Jean. That was wonderfully presented. Thank you. All right. Next up, we have a wonderful poem by Jenny Callahar called When Winter Steals My Colors.
Hello.
Are you all ready, Jenny?
I'm ready. Our internet connection is a little iffy, so let's hope it hangs in there.
Okay.
Hello, everyone. When winter steals my colors, blueness seeps from my eyes tonight. Red leaks from my pumping heart into a spill. Whiteness settles among the roots at my forehead, and black noise congests these straining ears. Colors hurt, lack of color even more. It pains me when fragile pigments burst. My birthmark melts from wrist to fingers, permanently inking all I touch. These lips long for scorching kisses, tough and tender both, to paint them pink again. Eyes in winter forget rainbows exist. All is dull, sharply gray, black and white. When spring stops teasing and returns, I'll reach higher than I ever have to steal blueness from the sky, borrow redness from a startled robin's breast, dye my hair in whatever thawed pond I can find. With only the snapping sounds of breaking buds and the heavy flaps of owls as they swoop brownly from their lofts, I'll see clearer, farther, truer, without the crusting, muting blankets of ice and sin covering everything.
Great job, Jenny. I just love that. Thank you so much. That was perfect. Patrick, you don't need to mute the mic because you're next. Patrick Callahar is going to give us an excerpt. I kind of say that word right. Excerpt from his wonderful award-winning piece, The Fateful Hour. Take it away, Patrick.
Okay, let's hope it gets through because I've been the one wiggling the connection to keep it going.
Oh, okay. So, okay, well, everybody cross your fingers.
Yeah. The fateful hour. I first saw him in Battery Park in the summer of 1970. He was leaning at a precarious angle against the painted steel rails that were his only hindrance to a watery death in New York Harbor. The Statue of Liberty stood directly behind him. In incongruous backdrop to the drunken rant the man was delivering against Marshal Josip Broz Tito, Yugoslav president for life. He wore an old suit over a dingy white shirt open at the collar. He had a beer bottle in one hand and a lit cigarette in the other, both of which he waved around furiously. Listening to him, I thought of Ben Franklin and Lenny Bruce at its most anti-religious and most profane, very astute and very much to the point. I always wanted to be a writer, so I collected people the way some people might collect rocks or keep a list of bird sightings. People who were weird or eccentric or playing. Of them or mock them, never that. But I also didn't see them as people with their own joys or sorrows and their own triumphs as well as failures. I never thought about them as somebody's son or daughter or as children running and playing in open fields or working on farms or negotiating the mean and dirty streets of a big city slum. To me, they were characters in a story. All that changed that day in Battery Park. I walked away. I went up to him and asked him his name and why he hated Tito so much. The man leaned toward me and pinned me with his eyes. His look was much more sly than drunk. Then he smiled, slightly shook his head, and placed his fingers, nicotine stained and ingrained with dirt, along knows, but Mio knows. Tell me why you hate Tito. I really want to know. Nobody knows, but Mio knows. So tell me. His eyes looked away from mine and seemed to refocus on something distant in both time and place. I knew him, Tito. Only he wasn't called Tito then, just plain Josip Broz, not from any of the mountain villages in our area, further away. We were all fighting the Nazis. I was told the word in English for what we were, partisans. Somebody in
Okay,
go ahead. Josip was a communist. The rest of us were plain mountain villagers trying to get rid of the Germans and protect our homes and families. But Josip had other plans. He had ambitions. Then there was a long silence. Mio was far away in his thoughts. Abruptly, he said, "Let's get some beer. I know a place quite close in your buying." I said, "Of course." The bar was the kind of place that was familiar in every seaport in the world. Sawdust on the floor and smelling of urine, stale beer, and danger. Mio went up to the bar with the $10 bill I had given him and came back with 8 bottles on a battered tray. He didn't offer me any change. He lined up the 8 bottles in front of him like a row of soldiers on parade and opened one. Then he made a vague gesture toward the row and said, "Have one."
to be continued.
That's right. That's an excerpt. So you really do want to read the whole thing. It's a wonderful piece. It really draws you in, you know, and the excerpt was given just a hint and a taste of that. So thank you, Patrick, for sharing that with us. That was awesome. All right. Next up, our good friend, Chuck Kellum. Chuck, I know you're here. I can't see your face because I've got mine on speaker view, but you are going to read your untitled haiku senryu for us, please. Where are you, Chuck?
I'm here.
Okay, there you are.
thank you, Alice and Sarah, for doing this wonderful book. I'm not sure whether this is a haiku or a senryu, somewhere in the middle, maybe. Daylight savings time gives and takes an hour each way. Sun and moon don't care.
I just love that. It says it all in three short lines. Great job, Chuck. That was just wonderful.
Thank you.
And thank you for reading it for us tonight. I read that to myself out loud a couple times, just so you know, and I don't think I could do it justice the way you do. So thank you for sharing it. Okay, so next up, our good friend David Allen is going to read us his poem, Time and Time Again. David, are you ready? I know David's here. David. David? I thought he was here.
Hello.
Oh, there you are.
I thought you...
Take it away, David. Oh, you're muted. You're muted. You gotta unmute. David, you're muted.
Okay. Got me now? All right, I'll just go into this. It's called Time and Time Again. You want to know about time? Well, time is of the essence. You have the time, remember, time waits for no man, and Father Time at no time bides his time. We all know there's no time like the present, and there's little time to waste. So hear me out this time, because the time is ripe. Anyway, if you just take the time, you'll realize there's a time and a place for everything. And though the bad times seem to always follow the good times, at one time or another, we all learn that only time will tell if the third time really is the charm. Just mull on this in your spare time, would you? Time weighs heavy on this time of life, but time can also work wonders, even if you're living on borrowed time. So here's to you this time. I am wishing you a whale of a time, hoping you're not wasting time counting the seconds, minutes, and hours, parsing your time, getting lost in the mists of time, until at last you run out of time and finally realize time is no longer on your side. So it's now just time to call it a day, marking time as we are all washed away in the sands of time, because time and tide wait for no man. Thank you.
Great job, David. Thank you. That was fun.
Okay. All of these other serious poems and poets, and you have me reading.
We have serious, we have funny. That's what's great about this project, is we get such a variety of things. And you submitted some serious poetry too, so you know, we just thought that would be fun for you to share, because I'm not sure I've ever read a poem that had pretty much every single cliche phrase I've ever heard about time in it the way you wrote that poem. So we just thought that would be a lot of fun. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
Yeah.
This has been At the Roundtable with Alice
and Sarah E.
of Community Education Arts.
Our nonprofit organization is based in Noblesville, Indiana. You can find us online at cearts.org. We'd like to thank James Weston for writing our intro music and for his technical savvy.
Join us next time
at the Roundtable.